You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. A few school districts around the state are planning on returning to in-person instruction this fall, and decisions are expected from other districts soon. What is it all going to look like? We'll talk about some of the issues facing schools and how they could deal with them coming up. Now, companies like Starbucks, Adidas, and Clorox have joined the call to stop spending their advertising dollars on Facebook over the kinds of speech it allows on the platform. Critics say the company has allowed people to incite actual violence and spread hate and misinformation. Here's Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg defending the site's decision not to moderate political speech.
And I think political speech is one of the most sensitive parts in a democracy, and people should be able to see what politicians say.
Ad spending on Facebook accounts for more than 98% of its annual $70.7 billion in revenue. Could the ad boycott lead to some kind of change? Steve Knoll is a marketing professor and social media expert at Madison College. Steve, welcome back to Central Time.
Cool. Thanks for having me back, Rob.
Well, we've talked a lot about Facebook and the kind of things that appear on it over the years. What kind of things are critics pointing to when they raise concerns about Facebook and the kind of speech it can help promote?
Well, it's kind of been an ongoing battle with Facebook. There's a lot of people that have been posting some really, really nasty and offensive stuff on Facebook. And Facebook is caught a little bit in the middle. On one hand, they're doing some good things to try to root out some of this awful, offensive content. But at the other hand, there's a fine line between, you know, First Amendment and just, you know, opinions you don't agree with. And a lot of people have been really, you know, pushing Facebook to say they need to take a much, you know, harder stance at some of this speech that, you know, borders on First Amendment, but at the same point can be really, really offensive and especially very racist.
Yeah, and one of the concerns I know is the idea that Facebook has been weaponized, either, you know, as an organizing zone for a hate group, mm-hmm. or, you know, of course, by Russian disinformation groups, things like that. And you see extreme cases in countries like Myanmar where, you know, generals were using Facebook to promote an actual genocide against minority groups in their country. So where do people draw the line, I guess, between, you know, just opinions versus calls to really bad action?
Right. And I'm glad you used the term weaponized, because this is something that people really need to understand. You know, I've been studying, you know, social media over a decade now. It's crazy. And I have long argued that this could be an incredible weapon. And a lot of people really dismissed that idea for a long time, really saying, oh, how can something, you know, that's basically about sharing cat videos be a weapon? And unfortunately, it's taken this long for a lot of people to realize the power that marketing wields, and especially social media. And in fact, there was a story yesterday. Facebook just banned a bunch of Brazilian Facebook accounts that were connected to the president. And basically, they were using them to post a lot of, you know, pro-right-wing content towards his government. And Facebook discovered this, and as of yesterday, they announced that they pulled down several accounts, both on Facebook itself and also on Instagram. So this is something that, you know, people that don't necessarily, you know, walk a good moral line have known for years that, you know, social media is definitely an area that it's really easy to manipulate people. It's easy to persuade people. A lot of people, when they're on social media, do not really vet any type of story. And it's human nature to want to share bad news. We do that. And as a species, we do that. And so when people, you know, see this content, you know, they're quick to say, oh, I told you so, and want to share it with all their friends, not realizing that what they're sharing is a blatant lie. And this has been an ongoing issue, and there is no easy way to clean this up. You know, Facebook can't just flip a switch. You know, part of it is when people post, think of how many millions, if not billions, of things are posted on social media every single day. And no human being, no army of human beings can possibly vet this stuff before it gets posted. So Facebook relies on, you know, computer-driven artificial intelligence algorithms. And the algorithms are only as good as the programmers who built them. And, you know, unfortunately, as soon as they build a new program, somebody figures out a way to get around it. There's an old saying, you know, when man builds the perfect mousetrap, nature will build a better mouse. And I think we're seeing that, you know, in action. That, and it's not just Facebook. That's the thing is, though, is Facebook is really the, you know, the face, of social media. But this is not just Facebook. It's Google, you know, it's Twitter, it's Snapchat. But, you know, those are smaller companies that don't have so many big stockholders like Facebook does. And this is why I think Facebook is treading very lightly. Is they're worth a lot of money, and there's a lot of people that own stock in Facebook. And you know, there's a fine line between, you know, saying, "Oh, we really don't like these comments, so we're going to pull it off," and then, you know, their stock price. Quite honestly, so I personally, I'm happy to see corporate America kind of stepping up to the plate and saying, "Okay, Facebook, you know, you've been naive." You know, that, and that's probably Facebook's biggest crime, is they've always thought people will always choose to do the good thing and the right thing. And that's just not human nature. And, you know, it's finally catching up to them.
Let's talk about, Steve, that other player coming in now. These companies, they love the access that they get to people on Facebook, I imagine. They pay a lot of money to get their ads front and center in front of us when we're on Facebook. What has tipped now that we have so many companies saying, you know, we're going to take a month off of advertising, we're going to stop advertising indefinitely or until something gets fixed here? Why have we hit this tipping point where some big names are pulling their money out of Facebook ads?
Well, I think a lot of this is tied to all the racial protests that have popped up in the last few months due to all the recent tragedies. You know, that definitely has been a turning point for, you know, a lot of companies, a lot of people. You know, this is one of those, you know, zeitgeist moments in culture where a shift is occurring. Something is definitely happening, and it's really hard to say this and this made that. There's a saying in marketing that 2 + 2 doesn't always equal 4. It depends on if it's sunny or rainy. So this is not precise stuff that you can point to. This happened, then this happened, and as a result, this is happening. But I really think, you know, a lot of the unprecedented protests that we've seen since May has really brought a lot of companies' attention to people exploiting social media and a lot of, you know, ugly racist views. And I think a lot of companies are saying, you know what, we are hearing a lot from our customers. And quite honestly, you know, we don't want to hear about it anymore. So do something about it. And, you know, unfortunately, in corporate America, you know, it's all the money. It's always about the money. But now that it's tipping, you know, enough consumers are rising up and saying, you know, I don't know if I want to buy your product anymore if you're going to continue to support outlets like this. And I think a lot of companies got together. And now this is the interesting thing is this so-called Facebook boycott. And I'm hesitant to use the word boycott because, you know, traditional history has shown that advertising boycotts generally do not work. But a lot of big companies have pledged, you know, not to use Facebook or Instagram. Because, you know, Facebook and Instagram, same company. A lot of people forget that. They've said, you know, for the month of July, we're just going to, you know, pause our spending. But, you know, come August 1st, you know, are they going to all come rushing back? You know, that's a question. I think a lot of these companies will look at their bottom line and see if they saw a big drop in sales or they can correlate it to not being on Facebook and Instagram, they're going to be back. You know, they're going to say, you know, they're going to keep saying, well, you know, we would like Facebook to do the right thing, but if it's going to affect our sales and it's still an effective marketing tool, those dollars will come back.
We're talking to Steve Knoll, marketing professor and social media expert at Madison College. He's with us to talk about the growing pressure on Facebook to moderate content on the site. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you want to see Facebook monitoring its content, if at all? Do you encounter a lot of awful stuff sometimes when you're on Facebook, or is it pretty benign from where you're sitting? Call in at 800-642-1234. And what do you think these companies saying, hey, we're holding back on spending until Facebook can at least clarify how they're handling things like hate speech and misinformation campaigns? 800-642-1234 is the number, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about a recent withdrawal of ads by many companies on Facebook might change the way it regulates speech on the platform when it comes to hate speech, misinformation. Our guest is Madison College marketing professor Steve Knoll, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you want out of Facebook when it comes to hate speech, to organizing campaigns to do bad stuff in real life, to organize misinformation campaigns? Have you run into stuff that makes you wonder, what is this? Where is it coming from? Why aren't they stopping it? Or do you think they should be hands off? You say they're a platform and anything goes, more or less. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Steve, we heard from a couple people on our Ideas Network Facebook page. Peter writes, they monitor the content too much as it is. Shouldn't they be regulated like cable TV at this point? Facebook should go back to being for college kids, Peter writes. It's much more productive and an interesting place back in 2006. So, Peter, and I think not alone, Steve, in thinking platforms like Facebook and other social media platforms should be more hands-off.
Well, and here's a big question is, who makes those decisions? You know, if someone says, oh, I don't like this content, and somebody else says, oh, I love that content, who's right? Who gets to make that decision? And that's kind of, you know, what is it, the expression from 1984? Who monitors the monitor, or who censors the censors? That's kind of an ongoing question. And there's a fine line between First Amendment constitutional right of free speech and then your opinion. And that's a real, real difficult line for a company to, you know, regulate. And I think no matter what they say, if Facebook or any company were say, well, we're not going to allow this, you know, somebody is not going to be happy. And it's on both sides. It's on the left side as well as the right side. So, you know, again, Facebook is kind of stuck in the middle. They're doing some stuff. A lot of people think they could be more proactive with it. You know, Twitter got a lot of publicity earlier when they said they were not going to accept any political advertising the rest of this year. But the reality is Twitter's political advertising is about 2% of their revenue, where with Facebook, it's significantly higher. They won't disclose how much higher, but it's in the hundreds of millions of dollars. So it's big money.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Mike is with us in Madison. Mike, hello.
Hello. Yeah, I just wanted to, I just didn't quite understand how these online ads equate to purchases. I know I've accidentally clicked on them, and I might have been curious enough to click on an ad and go to the site, but I never have purchased anything from these clickbait or these click ads. Generally, I'll go to reviews, maybe Amazon reviews, read the reviews, and then decide what I'm going to buy. How do they justify these companies spending millions on Facebook ads? How do they measure that they're actually getting anything for their buck?
Mike, thanks a lot for the call.
Yeah,
Steve, what do you think?
It's similar. Yeah, you don't have to buy anything. The mere fact that you are checking this stuff out, you're leaving what are called cookies. There's little digital breadcrumbs that are being left behind as you go from website to website to website. And a lot of these companies, you know, they're all kind of connected together. Like, for example, Gmail. If you use Gmail, which is Google Gmail, and then you use a Gmail account to log into an Amazon account along with your Facebook page, now those companies can kind of follow you around and say, hey, he looked at this product three different times. Let's start showing him ads for products like that. So you can go to Amazon and look up a red t-shirt, And then you could log on to Facebook and instantly see an ad for red t-shirts. That's how fast it is. And by the way, you gave these companies permission to follow you around. You know, all these tools, Facebook, Google, they're all free to use. And in the terms of agreement that you clicked on, it says they will do this. And that's how they make money, is by selling that to advertisers. But nobody reads these terms. Everyone just clicks, races through, clicks it, and goes for it. And nobody's, you know, consumers have refused to pay for social media. There have been numerous studies saying, would you pay $2 a month for Facebook? And people overwhelmingly say, no, Facebook needs to be free. Well, nothing is free. So the price of having free access to Facebook or free access to Google is that they get to follow you around and then put advertiser messages in front of you based on, you know, what your history is. That's the business model of social media.
In our last minute or so, Steve, I think no matter what Facebook does in response to this action by corporations, this is a conversation that's not going to end when they make that move, or this year, or probably the next 5 years.
They won't. And it's only going to get more and more ugly as we get closer and closer to the election. You know, just yesterday, Facebook announced that they pulled a whole bunch of fake accounts connected to Roger Stone. You know, I think it was a lawyer for Trump who got indicted. They said that he had 54 accounts, 50 pages, and 4 Instagram accounts, all fake, all connected to him, all putting out made up information with basically right wing propaganda. That's just the how politics works these days. You know, in Madison, we're seeing a recall effort for the Democrat mayor. It's being led by a Republican, you know, specifically to just get people angry. You know, that's how the digital war is fought in 2020. And it's only going to get messier as time goes on.
Steve, we'll leave it there. Thanks, as always, for joining us today.
Great. Thanks for having me again, Rob.
We've been talking to Steve Knoll, marketing professor and social media expert at Madison College. He talked to us today about a number of companies withdrawing their ads, at least temporarily, from Facebook, and what kind of changes people are looking for from the social media giant. It's been more than a month since George Floyd was killed by police in Minneapolis, sparking nationwide Black Lives Matter protests. Thousands have marched in big and small demonstrations across Wisconsin. Megan Hart reports some Wisconsinites are also showing their support with their wallets.
Starting a new business is difficult at the best of times. Seneca Kirk opened Playground Clothing in Green Bay in December.
I got Preem, which is a good denim. Jordan Craig, they're a good stretch denim.
He says the area was lacking an option for urban menswear.
A lot of people travel back and forth to the bigger cities to go shopping, so I tried to bring some of the items here.
Little did Kirk know that months later, businesses across the state would be required to close due to the coronavirus pandemic.
It was definitely slowed down the business, especially by me being a new business. Everyone didn't even know about me yet.
Playground was one of the first stores in the area to sell cloth face masks. That helped, but Kirk was soon to encounter another challenge. The store was robbed during Green Bay's most heated night of protests.
The window damage was the whole entire door actually was busted, so it's fixed now.
Kirk doesn't believe any protesters were involved in the burglary, but still it was another setback. When news of the robbery hit Green Bay, many community members wanted to help. Local Black Lives Matter organizers put together a GoFundMe that's raised more than $4,000. Some people even returned stolen merchandise they found for sale online. In recent weeks, Kirk says people from all different backgrounds have stopped in to check out the store.
Got a lot of support from the community, a lot of donations, significant donations actually. So it's been a good moment for me.
Support for Black-owned businesses has grown in recent weeks as both the protests and the coronavirus pandemic have highlighted racial disparities. A new study from Wallet Hub shows Wisconsin's economy ranks dead last among U.S. states in terms of racial equality. Meanwhile, Black Wisconsinites account for just 6% of the state's total population, but nearly 20% of its coronavirus deaths. Like Kirk, Milwaukee native Rick Banks and his business partner, Paul Wellington, launched a new venture in the weeks before the coronavirus shutdown. They started MK Black in January. The Black-owned business database is available online or as an Android app. Banks says new businesses are asking to be added to the site almost every day, and it saw more than 20,000 visitors on one day in early June.
So we have almost 400, if not over 400 by now, Black-owned businesses in our database, and that's excluding, you know, churches and things like that. So, it's been pleasantly surprising.
The push to support Black business owners comes as research shows they may have the most difficult time recovering from the economic effects of the coronavirus pandemic. Black business owners across the country were unable to work in April at almost twice the rate of their white counterparts. Dr. Henry McCoy is a faculty member at the School of Business at North Carolina Central University. He says this moment is unique because the mainstream discussion is starting to acknowledge institutional racism, and major corporations have entered the fray. But he's not sure society has reached a tipping point in the fight for economic equality.
The question becomes, you know, how sustainable is this effort?
McCoy says the issues that Black business owners have historically faced, like denial of credit or access to capital, aren't going to be solved overnight. Generations of discrimination have also made it so Black-owned businesses are underrepresented in some places and sectors.
You know, it's a really challenging. I mean, they say, okay, I need to build a new home. Let me find a Black contract. I need to buy a new car. I need to find a Black dealer. And you don't have a Black manufacturer.
Still, McCoy says the current push to support Black-owned businesses could make a difference for some entrepreneurs. After all, happy customers are likely to come back. Rick Banks thinks it could make a difference for communities, too.
We want strong, thriving communities. Then we have to have strong businesses, and it has to be supported by everybody, not just Black people.
But the interest in supporting these businesses has to be sustained for it to achieve long-term change. Megan Hart, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up, we'll look at some of the questions that Wisconsin school districts are grappling with as they decide whether to open schools again this fall amid the COVID-19 pandemic. A Wisconsin pediatrician joins the show. We'll look at guidelines from the national organization that represents pediatricians, and you can join in. You can get started. What would it take to reopen schools safely in the fall? Love to hear from parents, students, teachers, staff, and others. You can get started right now over at the Ideas Network Facebook page. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 8 on The Morning Show, it's a weekly call-in for kids and parents. This week's special guest is Avi, author of lots of books for kids and young adults. Join the show tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. Now, Wisconsin school districts are figuring out what to do about the upcoming school year amid the coronavirus pandemic. At least three districts in southeastern Wisconsin, Cedarburg, Oconomowoc, and Kettle Moraine, have announced that they plan to open with in-person instruction and safety measures. Others are considering a variety of options, like a mix of in-person and virtual learning, only having half the student population in the building at a time, and more. Earlier this week, President Trump said his administration is going to put pressure on governors to open schools in their states. He also threatened to cut funding to schools that don't fully reopen. Yesterday on Fox News, Education Secretary Betsy DeVos defended the president's comments.
American investment in education is really a promise to students and their families. And if schools aren't going to reopen again, that's breaking that promise. And so why should they receive funds for something they're not going to do?
Meanwhile, the American Academy of Pediatrics also says students should be physically present in schools as much as possible and that there are health, social, and educational risks to keeping kids at home. They've released a set of guidelines to make the school experience as safe as possible. Dr. Dipesh Navzaria is an associate professor of pediatrics at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. He's also president of the Wisconsin chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. Dr. Navzaria, good to have you back with us.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
This set of guidelines from the American Academy of Pediatrics starts with the principle that we're best off if we can get kids in schools in person as much as possible. Why is that important?
Well, the thing is that I think we primarily think about school as being a place for learning and education, which is really the main goal of schools. However, we need to also recognize that there's a lot of different things that happens when children are in a school, and particularly physically in a school. There are other caring adults who have their eyes on those children and how in terms of their mental health, in terms of their physical health, in terms of looking for signs of abuse or distress or depression or anxiety. There's a lot of children who are served who have developmental disabilities or other special needs, and they are often not getting the therapies they need or other supports. Child poverty, food, schools actually are a major bedrock of our community. That we sometimes don't always recognize. So we need to realize that when kids are not in school, a lot of those things are lost to them or are only being provided in very peripheral ways, unfortunately.
And I'm assuming I'm not the only parent who, when schools went virtual, they did the best they could. They were scrambling in a tough situation. I think there's a general consensus that kids weren't learning as much remotely as they would have in person. Is that fair to say?
It probably is. I think there's a big difference between parents who make the reasoned, planned decision to homeschool and those who are thrown into it on short notice with little preparation and not really sure how to do it. And let's face it, that virtual school is hard. You know, in an ideal world, we'd love to have synchronous classes where kids all get together on Zoom and at the same time and kind of recreate a classroom setting. Well, when you have large numbers of families that don't have access to broadband, what ends up happening is that some kids are essentially being excluded from school because of those resource limitations. So we need to recognize, again, that it was not an ideal situation, and it worked to get us through the second half of, you know, the spring semester and through the end of the school year. But now that we're planning about what we do next year, we need to think more carefully about this and also recognize that what we've learned about this pandemic has evolved since this all hit us in March.
Governor Evers was asked yesterday about DeVos's position on fully reopening schools. Here's a listen to what he had to say.
At the end of the day, I would not consider a district who offers a hybrid where it's partially in school, partially online, to be failing in their responsibilities. They have to make that decision locally. I don't think that's something that Secretary DeVos can discern necessarily from Washington, D.C.
Do you see room for that, Dr. Nafzaria, that mix of in-person and virtual instruction?
I think that certainly can happen. I think what we need to recognize is that there is no one magic set of guidelines that's going to cover all situations. I wish there was. For one thing, we don't have as complete data about how this virus acts as we would like to have. And we need to go with the research and the evidence that we have rather than the evidence we wish we had. Number two is that we want to be careful of providing such specific guidelines, such as all schools must open or all schools must not do sports, et cetera, et cetera. Because if you're overly specific, what will happen is we might actually not be addressing particular needs or particular resources that an individual school or school district might have. We need to instead take a flexible, thoughtful, and nimble approach so that especially as situations change on the ground in terms of community spread or new data or research becomes available that is accepted as telling us something important and useful about how we should address this, that we can change and adjust. That sort of thoughtful approach actually will serve us not just in schools, but also early childhoods, public libraries, really any kind of public arena, I think would be well served by really planning to be flexible. One of the things that I think is really important about the AAP guidance, people are summarizing it as the AAP says that schools must reopen. That is not at all what it says. The AAP specifically says that The goal should be for students to be physically present in school. However, we need to make sure we do it safely, and we need to make sure that schools are adequately funded to be able to do this. So there's a lot of ifs in that need to also happen. And I think when we just say AAP says reopen and stop there, we're actually doing the guidance that was carefully thought out a disservice, and we're ultimately doing school districts, school personnel, and ultimately children and their families a disservice.
Dr. Depeshnov Zarya is with us from the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, one of the Wisconsin chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. We're talking about schools reopening in the fall amid COVID-19, what they can do to reopen as safely as possible. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Love to hear your thoughts on this, especially if you're a parent, a student, a teacher, a school staffer yourself. Are you in the midst of making these plans right now? What kind of things are you looking at? What kind of changes can your students expect? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Dr. Nafzaria, you mentioned that those AAP guidelines stress the need for flexibility at the local level and as information changes over time. That said, what are some of the guidelines that they are hoping school administrators and others are thinking about? What kind of safety steps are they putting out there for people to consider?
Yeah, here's some basic points that I think we've all heard, but they bear, you know, reiterating. So one, clean and disinfecting those high touch surfaces, frequent washing of hands, spacing desks about 3 to 6 feet apart, fewer students and staff in each classroom, and trying to keep those classrooms, of course, as a unit as much as possible and not mixing with others. That also means having teachers perhaps move between classrooms rather than the students to avoid intermixing in the halls. Lunches, well, might not have to be the cafeteria, might be at their desks. Using outdoor spaces where it's possible or feasible. Masks for adults and the older students. And then finally, really being prepared that if the virus surges, the flexibility to go virtual on really a moment's notice if need be, since this is a little bit more of a predictable situation at this point in time. All of these things they're not easy to do necessarily, and they're going to take some work and planning. And that's where maybe some of these hybrid approaches become necessary. A school may say, there is no way we can do the distancing with our full student body. Okay, great. We're going to have to do a mix of virtual and hybrid. That is still serving learning in key ways, and it's the school making that decision or the school district making that decision to really help things out. A lot of these are covered very nicely on the AAP's parent portal, healthychildren.org, in the article on return to school, including the points I just made.
You wrote a piece, I think this is a couple of months back now, that nobody should take one thing and think this is the one magic cure. Okay, we got masks on everybody, we're all cool. Not looking for that silver bullet that's going to fix everything.
Yeah, that's really correct. That, you know, if you're really looking to try to limit virus spread, it's the things that we've largely been talking about and been hopefully doing well. So the most strict thing would be a strict quarantine, right? You do not interact with other people at all and so on. After that, it's social distancing. After that, it's hand hygiene and masks and things of that nature. And after that, other things. So, you know, it's not that masks alone are going to solve everything, but they're a piece of the solution. It's not that distancing alone is going to solve everything or outdoor spaces are going to solve everything. But all these things put together actually add up to a fairly large effect in terms of being protective, in terms of virus spread. So there's not just one thing that's going to fix this. It's all of these things being thought about. And the other thing I'll say is we need to be kind and gentle and patient with each other. Some of these kids are relatively young. They're going to forget to keep their mask on. They're going to not have it on correctly. They might forget to wash their hands exactly right. One lapse is not going to cause a mass outbreak. Okay, this is really about repeated behaviors over and over and good modeling by adults and creating situations where the kids, if they do lapse, it's not a big deal because, hey, they were distanced when that unmasked child coughed, you know, or something like that. So I think really thinking about it in all these sorts of ways as a multi-layer approach is really how school districts and other locations should be thinking about all this.
We're looking at the effort to reopen schools safely this fall amid the COVID-19 outbreak. Dr. Depeshnov Zarya is with us, Associate Professor of Pediatrics at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health and President of the Wisconsin Chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see schools open this fall? What kind of safety measures are you hoping that schools take? If you're a parent or a student, do you have concerns? Do you have questions you need answered? If you work in a school yourself, What are you hoping for? What are you fearing? And if you're involved in making these kind of decisions right now, love to hear from you. The number is 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also join the conversation over at the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about efforts to reopen schools safely this fall. Dr. Dipesh Navsaria is with us, Associate Professor of Pediatrics at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. He's also president of the Wisconsin chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. We're looking at guidelines put out by the American Academy of Pediatrics when it comes to opening schools safely. Call in at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see schools reopening in the fall? What kind of safety measures are you hoping to see? Parents, students, teachers, school staff, and administrators, what is on your mind right now? What concerns do you have? What hopes do you have? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We heard from some people on Facebook, Dr. Navsaria. Kirsten writes, on the one hand, I would like to see my teacher have normal socialization again. On the other hand, I want him to have another 70 years of productive life unharmed by lifelong neurological or cardiovascular effects, or worse yet, dead. I'd also like to see him live to grow up. I think every parent wants that. This is going to be going through a lot of parents' minds, Dr. Navsaria, the possible trade-offs and risks when kids go back to school.
Yeah, I think that's certainly a big question, and unfortunately, we don't have hard numbers to really weigh that risk. I think that one of the important things we should be thinking about, though, is that we take risks on every day that we forget exist. I point out that every time you get into a motor vehicle to drive somewhere, there's actually a fair chance of getting into a severe or fatal motor vehicle collision. But we don't think about that as much because the numbers of how many people die on, say, Wisconsin highways every year is we're numb to it, right? We don't really think about that anymore. Yet that threat is still there. So I think we should be careful about not overestimating risk. And let's remember that children in general seem to have much milder illness and that the headlines that we do see are largely about relatively rare conditions. They are concerning conditions when they happen, but they are relatively rare. The other thing I also want to point out is that for adults or children who have significant health conditions that put them at higher risk, that really needs to be a conversation between them and their healthcare provider. And then a decision made on their individual situation. And schools need to be flexible for kids who need a virtual setup or something else because of those risks and make sure that they are addressing their educational and other needs to the extent possible. And also for staff, I have to say, I think that human resources departments of school districts need to be kind and compassionate and try to work with adult staff members that do say, hey, I'm at higher risk here, but I still want to be able to contribute. We need to be kind and gentle with each other.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642 with us in Green Bay. Logan, hi.
Hi. Well, thanks to the doctor for covering quite a bit of ground, and I'm certain it's going to help educators. It's sad that politics have to permeate every aspect of our life. Education should be determined by the school district themselves, and they shouldn't be bullied by somebody on top. Forcing kids to go to school if it places them at risk. So therefore, conditions should be taken into account, and no school district should be do something that's against the health of the kids. Thank you, sir.
Logan, thanks a lot for that call. And Dr. Navsaria, that's where that flexibility that you and the American Academy of Pediatrics are calling for, the consideration might be different if there's a district in a place where suddenly there's a surge in community spread of coronavirus, or if there are some other conditions that make their students or staff more vulnerable.
Absolutely. And I think that's where they have to weigh the conditions. They also need to weigh questions like how many of your kids need to take a school bus? How many do not? All of those things, play into this. I'll also echo what some of my colleagues at the AAP has said. The American Academy of Pediatrics is resolutely apolitical, but we are unabashedly pro-kid. This is about the children and what's best for them. Mm-hmm. So I completely agree. This shouldn't be about the politics. This should be about what is best for children and families. And we should be really thoughtfully and carefully thinking about that and analyzing what we have.
Thanks a lot for that call, Logan, at 800-642-1234. We're talking about reopening schools as safely as possible with Dr. Dipesh Nafzaria, pediatrician at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, also head of the Wisconsin chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. Back to your calls now. Ravi is with us in Milwaukee. Ravi, hi.
Hi, how are you? I have something to say that there should be intense training program for how to wear the mask. They should have the mask not over the mouth. They should close the nose as well and wear it tight above the to the bridge of the nose, and that's one mandatory process. The second thing, using larger rooms like an auditorium so that they are at least 9 feet away, because the aerosol particles are so small. 9 feet, the NPR News has said that.
Ravi, you're breaking up there. Thanks a lot for calling in. So first of all, that training for wearing masks and other safety precautions, Dr. Nafzaria, I believe that is part of the AAP guidelines, right?
Yes, it is. And, you know, I worked the election polls in April, and it was a great opportunity for me to observe the not very meticulous mask and hand hygiene and whatnot wearing by the general public. Because, you know, in healthcare, right, you get this really drilled into you multiple times and it's almost automatic. But I don't expect others to have that. So when people said, oh, if we just do hand washing and masks, we don't need to do this isolation. We can still do all these other things. And it's like, oh, boy. Wow, you know, a lot of you folks are just not very good at this. So yes, the mask down over the nose, ill-fitting, all of that plays into it. So some training is important.
Thanks a lot for that call, Ravi. I want to talk, Dr. Nafzaria, about what happens outside the school. I've seen some people make the case that, okay, if we want to prioritize opening schools, that's good and makes sense, but that might mean we have to make sacrifices elsewhere. We might have to accept more shutdowns so that we can send our school kids to school and not have that outbreak going on all around us. One person said they're going to make a bumper sticker I saw online, open schools, not bars, for example. Can we help the schools by doing stuff outside of the schools?
Well, certainly. I think that anything we can do to keep the rate of viral transmission down in our community is going to ultimately help all of us. I mean, the renowned health analysis organization of Goldman Sachs, of all people, pointed out that wearing of masks alone, by their analysis, would probably be a 5% contribution to the economy in terms of recovery because of how much sooner things would be able to open, et cetera. So it's not just about the schools and helping the schools. It's about helping the whole society. I want to be careful about a world in which we're trying to pit, say, the bars against the schools and all that. We should really be thinking about this and how can we help all people, right? Because the faster and the more completely that we have this pandemic come to an end, we will be able to go back to things as normal and be able to help everyone out, including businesses, including families that are struggling, including making sure everyone is gainfully employed and that kids are getting their education. And that's really what this comes down to, not a pitting of this versus that, but really of caring about each other as a society.
Dr. Nafzaria, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Dr. Dipesh Nafzaria is an associate professor of pediatrics at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. He's also president of the Wisconsin chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. We talked to them about health and safety in schools this fall. Well, you could still weigh in on this issue if you are watching this as a student, as a parent, a teacher, staff member, administrator, or just a concerned member of the public. When do you want to see kids back in schools? Should it be full on in person, a hybrid of in person and virtual, especially for the older kids? What safety precautions are you hoping to see? What are some of your worries? You can join us on the Ideas Network Facebook page and share your thoughts there, or you can always tweet us. We are at Central Time WPR. Let us know what you think. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, China is cracking down on Hong Kong. What is the reaction from the White House and Congress going to look like? We'll get some of the latest news from an NPR correspondent. With recent changes in state and federal law, farmers in Wisconsin are experimenting with hemp crops. We'll find out how Oneida Nation farmers are working to develop a market for their crop. Plus it's this week's edition of Food Friday. We'll do some cooking with berries. That and more coming up tomorrow on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the morning show with Kate Archer Kent. Tomorrow at 6, find out how museums are dealing with long-term closures because of COVID-19 and how you can visit them online. Find out about the programs they have for you even without coming in through the doors. That's tomorrow at 6 on the morning show. Up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then a reporter says the pandemic has put a spotlight on some of America's big workforce problems, from stagnating wages to concerns about workplace safety. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.